It's down to the left side. We will survive. And it's time to put in this. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burn the same driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the broadcast from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And before you leave that page, do me a favor, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media is there, always full of the latest podcast of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or share with your friends. And also check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace in partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting new things being put on the marketplace weekly. Language classes from the continent. Also, economics classes, social systems, health, and a lot more being taught by professors on the continent and in the diaspora. So check that out. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, special guest is joining us this evening. Historian, author, assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Doc will be joined to talk about her new book, Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. She'll be an interesting discussion with our guest this evening, and we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Not a Wu-Tang. All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before I get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard. Brother Richard, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
So how's it going? How's it going?
Everything.
I'm looking forward to this evening's discussion, though.
Everything is good. Everything is good. Mm-hmm. You know, ever since you told me about the book, I got it last week, or the beginning of last week. And I've been checking it out, and it's really interesting. It covers a period, Richard, that me and you talk about a lot on this program. I know you deal with this period at the museum, this period of black abolitionists and their mindsets, the things our ancestors felt about what was going on during that period, and solutions that they were trying to come up with that would help all of us during that period, whether you were bond or free. I think it's necessary to have our guest speak about it from her research and her point of view, looking at some of the documents, some of our ancestors' letters, her primary research during this period. And we're happy to have with us historian, author, and assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson is with us. Dr. Jackson, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you on Time for Awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing, Dr. Jackson?
Good to meet you. Nice to meet you.
Dr. Jackson, I know that you're with child. And congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This is baby number 3.
So you're a veteran, huh?
Yeah, baby number 3. And we're having a girl, so we're super, super excited. Although pregnancy hasn't been too kind to me, I'm constantly feeling sick. But I'm happy that for this moment, for right now, I feel good. So
That's a good sign.
And we're going to conversate. And if you have any difficulty or anything, you want to take a break, it's no problem.
Okay, thanks.
Dr. Jackson, let's start with this period, because I know you specialize in this period. Mm-hmm. When you teach mm-hmm. African studies, this 19th century and the period in this country and our ancestors' journey here. Let's talk about this from your perspective. The reason you wrote this book, I think it's necessary for our people to understand, because during this period, we have a narrative that have been put out by the general society that you had William Lloyd Garrison and a few others. Mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass seemed to have joined them, and they mm-hmm. were white abolitionists fighting to get our people out from under chattel bondage. And it mm-hmm. wasn't until Lincoln freed slaves that our people were free. I want you to talk about this from our perspective, our ancestors' perspective,
sure.
and open up why you wrote this book.
I think that's an excellent question, and it's a great place to start. I think that in a lot of ways, the way that history is presented to the broader public is very much through this perspective of white man's burden, and this idea that white men get to be both the villain and the hero, and that black people are always sort of the perpetual helpers. So Frederick Douglass is there, Harriet Tubman is there, they help, they're not the center, they're always at the periphery. And when I was in the archive and when I was doing all of my research, I just found that not to be true, that it was black people who were really at the center of this movement, black people who are the first abolitionists. Benjamin Quarles says this in 1969, and what I wanted to do was sort of take his famous work, Black Abolitionists, and really expand on it and make it even richer and deeper, and just let people know that, yes, no one had to tell black people that slavery was wrong, right? They knew this, they're the first to advocate for their freedoms, and they're really responsible for bringing other white abolitionists into the movement. You know, when you see someone like William Lloyd Garrison, he has this newspaper, The Liberator, but everyone who reads it is African-American. And so mm-hmm. his largest base is the African-American population. Without them, he would have no newspaper. So black people really are the fuel and the engine for this movement. And they dictate in a lot of ways which direction and at which pace the movement is able to see progress. And so I think for a lot of African Americans, it's affirming to read Force and Freedom. And I think for a lot of white Americans, it's refreshing because it's the first time they're getting a perspective that's sort of not centered on great white heroes.
Dr. Jackson, I notice a strange parallel in the philosophy of the early white abolitionists that seems to be eerily similar to the period of around 1960 to about 70, mm-hmm, the civil mm-hmm. rights, black power era, where it was a narrative put out to Dr. King and others, which they adopted, of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. We see that same tactic used by early white abolitionists to appeal to the moral suasion of their white brethren who was oppressing our ancestors. From your research, did any of our black abolitionists always buy into that? Did they buy into it for a period of time to see if it would work as a strategy? Because I could see that historical accounts show they never really bought this package. But I want you to talk about that from your research and what you've discovered from some of our ancestors and little known people that were black abolitionists that you talk about in your book.
Sure. There's a line in the book where I say, if moral suasion, and moral suasion was this idea that you could morally persuade people that slavery was wrong. You could tell planters slavery is a sin, slavery is evil. And you could say, you know, you could talk in this period of the 1830s in which there was a second great awakening, this religious revival. People believed that Christ was coming back, that he might come back next week or next month. And so they were trying to, these white abolitionists, use this religious revival to get people to repent and see the errors of their ways. And the number one way they did that was through moral suasion. Let's morally persuade them that this is wrong. But in the book, there's a line where I say, you know, if moral suasion is the house that Garrison built, like black people were just renters. They never really owned those principles. And so in the beginning, when the abolitionist movement is sort of formalizing and becoming a formal institution and organization all over the country, this is in about the 1830s, black people have no other allies, right? There's nobody else that's really talking about abolitionism or talking about emancipation as something that should be immediate. You know, people would say, maybe in 100 years we'll free the slaves. But the abolitionists were talking about no sort of freedom now. So they bought into that. They took any port in the storm. And this was the port where they felt most supported. But what black abolitionists started to do, the further they got into this movement, when it becomes the 1840s and the 1850s, they've been doing this for 20 years. And they haven't really seen any progress. And part of that is because they don't believe nonviolence or moral suasion is effective. And they say, if we're going to combat the institution of slavery, we have to combat it sort of with its own tools. If you understand that slavery starts in violence, it's sustained by violence. So black leadership said, well, the only way you're going to overthrow it then is through violence. And so they didn't have a lot of support, certainly from William Lloyd Garrison and the other white abolitionists who wanted to keep things peaceful. But they also understood that every time they used force, every time they used violence or self-defense or protective defense, that they were successful. And they sort of quailed a lot of these violent attacks that were happening against black communities when they actually started to fight back. So what I look at is, you know, what is the utility of nonviolence? How is it useful? How is it effective? How does it work? But then on the flip side, well, what's the utility of violence? And how is violence useful? And how does violence work? And I wanted to look at both sides of that and really see where black leadership fell on the spectrum.
One other thing I wanted to mention, then I'm going to let Brother Richard jump in because I know he got a bunch of things he wants to put out here. I want you to correct me if I'm wrong. After Denmark Vesey and that what happened to our ancestors in Charleston, the first time we see a written form of the pulse of black people or the black perspective was David Walker's appeal. Am I right there? And I got a part two.
Okay. No, David Walker's appeal, I would say, is the first radical, widely known piece of abolitionist literature in the 19th century. There are others who may allude to it, but that sort of direct, forceful, meet violence with violence rhetoric. David Walker's appeal, I mean, he's a pioneer in that respect. And a lot of people took what he said to heart. I also make clear in the book, though, that David Walker says, listen, if white people want to repent, they want to reconcile, then okay, reconciliation is on the table. But if they don't, we will not allow them to take the life of our mother or our brother or our sister or daughter, you know, without pushback. So he's not sort of talking about, you know, kill all whitey, right? Like, it's not just like a rampage from plantation to plantation. It's give up your slaves. If not, then don't be surprised when we fight back and when we seek your life in defending our own lives. And that defending our own lives is a God-given right. It's a natural right that we should be able to defend ourselves. And so that pamphlet that he produces, I mean, it goes all over the country. Black sailors are passing it all throughout the East Coast and into the South. It gets banned. Some black people can't even read, but they understand the power of just having that pamphlet on them. And so in a lot of ways, his words become a manifesto that his moment is not quite ready for. In 1829, in the 1830s, people are not ready for what David Walker has to say. But a lot of what he says gets echoed again in the 1850s, and finally people are ready to hear it, to receive it, and they actually publish his pamphlet again in the 1850s.
You know, when I want you to answer this question for me, Dr. Jackson, because I've read in some historical accounts of David Walker that some historians believe, because he was from the Wilmington area and went to Charleston, mm-hmm. that he was involved somehow with Denmark Vesey and that group. And when things fell mm-hmm. apart, that's when he left. Him, Morris Brown, and a few others were able to escape what had happened down there. Did you run across anything related to that in your research?
I haven't. You know, I've heard all of those things, but, you know, historians are also very much sticklers for evidence. And
okay.
So, it's not to say that it doesn't happen. I mean, there's a thing, there's evidence, but the absence of evidence does not necessarily mean that it didn't happen either. So just because we don't have a smoking gun or a letter that says, this is why I left, right? It doesn't mean that that's not necessarily true. So I'm always open to it because I also value oral history. And when Black people speak, I tend to believe them. And especially when they're speaking about things that I think often get discredited. So, you know, the idea or the rumor or the belief that he was connected to this would not be surprising to me at all. But have I been able to prove that or find that to corroborate it? No, I haven't.
Okay. Brother Richard, jump in. I know you want to put some things on the table. Brother Richard?
Can you hear me? Oh, damn, yes. I think that's I'm on now. Dr. Jack, what I wanted to start open up with was the point of how was free Africans viewed and in relationship to the general white society in general. And we always used it. We always say leadership. How was free Africans viewed to the general white society? And then how were they viewed in relationship to not just each other, but the African community in general?
Mm. So how were Black abolitionists viewed by whites and by Blacks?
Yeah. Because was they mostly free Africans when we talk about abolitionists or put that connotation? That's what I was trying to
Yes and no. So there are Black abolitionists who were born free, who never seen slavery. You know, all they knew was freedom. And then you have Black abolitionists like Frederick Douglass who were born into slavery and run away from slavery and join the movement. But I make clear in the book that not all Black people are abolitionists. That's very important to know. But pretty much all Black abolitionists are seen as leaders in their community. When it comes to how white people perceive them, there's also a quote in the book where in the Frederick Douglass paper, he says, you know, white people talked about Black people like they cared about their rights, but they were no more likely to believe that Black people were human beings than they were to believe that chalk was cheese. Mm. So, and, you know, another sort of anecdote I like to use is when I was at Howard University, one of my professors said, yeah, a lot of white abolitionists looked at slavery as like a free the whale campaign. So it was like, free the whales, don't hurt the whales. But then it was also, but whales can't vote, and whales can't marry my daughter, and whales aren't really people. So like, there's just all this passion about it. But at the same time, when we start talking about real equality, white people were able to separate emancipation and equality. They couldn't reconcile them as part of the same process. Where a lot of black abolitionists and black people said, well, emancipation's just the first step. Like, there's no point in emancipation if I can't vote, if I don't have rights, if I'm not a citizen, right? If I can't have any guarantees that come along with that freedom. So the biggest difference between like white abolitionists and black abolitionists is that black abolitionists believe in emancipation and equality, whereas a lot of white abolitionists only saw emancipation as the fight worth having, and equality was something completely, you know, not worthy of discussing in a lot of ways. So it's completely understandable to be someone who is anti-slavery and a racist. So you could be anti-slavery not because you wanted slavery to end or because you loved black people. You were anti-slavery because you understood how slavery undercut your economic bottom line, right? So no one's going to pay you $10 an hour when they have a slave to do it for free. So you were against the institution of slavery because of economic interests. But that didn't mean that you were pro-black. It didn't mean that you cared about black people's rights. It didn't mean that you wanted black people even around you. And that's how a lot of white Northerners felt about black people. You had free states, but in those free Northern states, black people weren't allowed to enter the territory sometimes. Black people weren't allowed to put their kids in school. They weren't allowed to have the basic rights that you think would be available to you in the North. So freedom in the North for black people is only quasi-free. There are absolutely no guarantees until after slavery ends and you get the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment and so forth.
One of the things that always a snippet that I guess I hold on to magnify your point is at the end of the Civil War, the distinction between Douglas and Garrison around, I believe Garrison believing that, you know, now is over, the fight is over, we won. And Douglas is saying, no, you know, as you said, until we have the voting rights and these other rights, then we're
the fight continues. It's really, I think in a lot of ways we need to shift our thinking and realize that emancipation is the beginning. It is not an end. It is the beginning of your rights, not sort of like the culmination of your rights.
And the thing that when you mentioned that all black abolitionists were, you know, all of Africans in that period weren't black abolitionists, during the Negro conventions or the color conventions, how did you get to see, how did that work out as far as those delegates, as far as because in a lot of times in those conventions, I forget what the number, 8 or whatever that they had, I mean, they would come from all over. To participate in that debate, discussion, and policy formation. How many black abolitionists, you know, or where did you see the largest number of black abolitionists during those colored Negro conventions?
That's a good question. So we don't have exact numbers because people are mobile, right? They're moving all over the place. But the biggest sort of cities or states where you have these large groups of, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry. The biggest cities, I would say, you're looking at Boston, you're looking at Syracuse, New York, you're looking at New York City, Philadelphia has a huge black population and a huge black abolitionist community. Ohio has large pockets of black abolitionists as well. So when they would have these conventions that you're talking about, these color conventions, people would travel from all over to get to Ohio or from all over to get to Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or Brooklyn or Boston. So it's hard to sort of get a fix on which groups had the largest group because people are coming from all over or which city has the largest group. But you knew which cities were, say, havens. You knew that you could be in, you know, Rochester, where Douglas lives, or Syracuse, or Boston, where the abolitionist capital is, or Philadelphia, where you have, like, the largest black free population. Those were typically known as, like, safe spaces to be in. Now, everyone who's in that space and who's attending the conventions, some people are just going because they're curious, right? Some people are like, hey, black people are getting up, what's going on, right? But not everybody is necessarily voting. So sometimes when you look at who's actually taking votes for what gets decided upon, those numbers are actually much smaller. So you might have a vote that's 18 to 19 or 38 to 42. So those numbers aren't that big, but the amount of people that are aware of what's happening in the black community, those numbers are much larger. But if you think about it, I mean, think about it in terms of like the Black Lives Matter movement today, right? Mm-hmm. So not everybody might don the t-shirt or go to a rally, but you're like, yeah, I'm here for you. I support it. You know, I'm gonna get $5, but like maybe being out on the streets is not your form of activism, or it's not your form of protest. So it's really hard to get an active role of like who's involved and who's not. And then there are other black people who are like, hey, listen, I've got a job. I've got too much on the line. I can't protest, or I can't wear that t-shirt. And so I can't be an abolitionist, or I can't be an activist in that way. Doesn't mean that black people didn't care. It just was, they risked a lot in being a part of the movement. And the same is in the, you know, the 1960s, and the same goes for today. It is work that puts you at risk, physical risk, emotional risk. It's intense labor to be a real activist in these movements.
It's two other things that is interesting that comes up in the book and what you developed, and it's a change framing, reframing the historical narrative. And that's one, John Brown being a follower. Why do you say that, and how do you develop that?
So actually, it's funny because that idea started in undergrad. So I was at Howard, and I had this graduate student who said to me, you know, John Brown is the coolest white man that ever lived. And I was like, okay, well, who's John Brown? So I started doing research on him. I wrote one of my papers on him. And I was like, you know, everyone's talking about this John Brown, but he's really a follower. He's not a leader. So, and when I started looking at how John Brown was watching other black people, how he felt that he needed Douglas. He tried to recruit him over and over again. He needed Harriet Tubman. He tried to recruit her. He needed Jermaine Logan and Lewis Hayden and Robert Purvis and all of these other black leaders to sort of get on board. And a lot of them were like, nah, bruh. Like, it's kind of like, you know, we're not going to follow you. Here's some money. We support you. But he was really trying to implement what he saw in Haiti, what he saw with Toussaint Louverture, what he saw with David Walker and with Henry Highland Garnett, and even in Nat Turner's slave uprisings. All of these things inspired him. So when I say that he's a follower, what he's doing is actively following black traditions, black rhetoric, black speeches, black rebellions or revolutions, and figuring out how can I take aspects of this and create our own momentum here in Harper's Ferry? How can I do what these people have done and try to be successful at it? Which is incredibly hard to do, right? There are no successful slave rebellions, unless you consider the Civil War to be that, but that's a whole nother, like, it's a whole nother category. Yeah. But yeah, I see him as, you know, he keeps a pocketbook of Toussaint Louverture and a speech about Toussaint Louverture, like, on his person at all times. And he really needed the help of black people to get off the ground. And so in that way, I see him completely as a follower. Now, is he a leader in that he definitely takes a step that other people are not willing to take? Absolutely. But he's not alone. There are five other black people that do join him in his cause and give up their lives for that cause as well. So it's a different way to spin it. And I think black people are so tired of, you know, white savior tropes and seeing, you know, white men sort of fall on their sword in a very disingenuous way over black humanity. And as much as I love John Brown, I will say that John Brown did seem, out of all the white abolition I've studied, to be the most committed to not just emancipation, but equality. He got it. He didn't use the same sort of language and words that we use today, but, you know, we might consider him woke, right? But he got it, why slavery was so wrong and what anti-blackness did to black people and what it did to white people. And in that sense, you know, I think John Brown is amazing and remarkable. But it's okay to say that he's also a follower, right? And I think it's okay to say that he's not a leader.
And definitely, well, what comes to my mind is the symbol of, I think it was a training camp in Canada, where prepare to possibly fight. But the thing that got me in your book that you emphasize, and this goes to the women that your book emphasized too, is her name Amelia R.N. Robinson? Is she?
Oh, yeah. She's the one that wrote the op-ed about Senator Charles Sumner being caned.
Right.
And she says, dare you meet a woman?
So that was interesting to me. But also, wasn't it a woman also who also find a wealthy woman who who was able to finance John Brown, or at least?
Oh yes, Mary Ellen Pleasant. So Mary Ellen Pleasant is so huge in this. I mean, she gives John Brown $30,000, which is a lot of money in the 19th century, and basically funds his entire campaign and says, you know, I would have given more if I could. I think that's one of the things, you know, that I strive to really point out in the chapter is that the greatest financier of John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry was a black woman from California who says, I'm willing to give you basically all I have and some to help you out in this cause. And I think, you know, just how we talk about how black people get pushed to the margins and white people get put at the center, black women routinely get pushed to the margins. And so they're seen, you know, as the helpers of all men, right? So I really wanted to talk about women who play even, you know, large roles like Mary Ellen Pleasant did, or even small roles like in the op-ed that Robinson puts forth. It's this idea that black women are ready, willing, and able, right? That the idea of the damsel in distress does not apply to them because they were never considered damsels. No one ever considered their duress, you know? And so they were fully on board when it came to using force and protective defense and violence. And so looking at violence and saying, this is not gendered, right? Women are participating. Women are buying guns. Women are carrying guns, you know, is another way of looking at a familiar moment in history and finding something different to focus on.
That's why I like the piece, Christiane. I think a lot of people don't really know about the Christiane Revolt, but point of Harriet Parker played in relationship to, and you were kind of graphic in the sense of the, what is that, the Federals, marshals are shooting.
Yes. Oh, that's a great story.
while she's blowing the trumpet.
Yes, she's sounding the alarm. So it is, I believe it's Eliza Parker. So Eliza Parker is William Parker's wife. And they had a plan that if they were ever met with resistance or slave catchers or slave owners, that they would, you know, sound the alarm, let the community know. They had formed their own, the Lancaster Black Protection, Self-Protection Society, so that they could support one another. And so when William Parker has four fugitive slaves who come to his home in the middle of the night seeking refuge, the master shows up hours later, knowing of Parker's reputation and knowing that his slaves are most likely with Parker. And they sort of stand Parker down, and Parker basically says, over my dead body, you're not getting these slaves back. They're not coming with you. And when his wife realizes that, listen, this is getting tense. They might go to blows. She runs up to the attic and starts blowing a horn to rally the troops, essentially, and to get the rest of the community to come to their aid. And within moments, 80 people, men and women, are armed with pitchforks, farm equipment, you know, pistols, whatever they can bring to defend these four fugitive slaves. And so it's really quite remarkable to me, even in that story, how the master, Edward Gorsuch, who's trying to retrieve his slaves, pretty much gets pummeled by his slaves and he's laying on the ground dying. And William Parker says, and the women put it into him. And it just, you know, it's really empowering for me to see, like, to read about women. You know, what did they do? Did they slit his throat? Did they snuff him out? You know, like, but it's I think it's an exciting moment in history in which you see that women, black women, are confronting slave owners and putting them to death and finishing them off, right? And taking a role in protecting fugitive slaves.
You know, Ellie, you always talk about what we learn from history, and Dr. Clark tells us, you know, to use history as a means to inform us. And when I heard about this protection society, especially, and now when we hear all these incidents, it's interesting that, and we look over Washington and whatever, here in the 19th century, where you had this example of people creating an organization around protection and a signal in order to deal at the most hostile moment. So it's just another thing that seems that we can learn what we need when we're talking about police violence and in our communities and things like that.
Even how people just like, and I've done this and I've seen other people do this. You see someone get pulled over and you just stop and videotape. And it's just a way of saying, like, I see you, bro. I'm watching. I got you. It's recording. You know what I mean? And it's you know, it's not a pitchfork. It's not a pistol, for sure. But just the arming yourself with a cell phone, right, to show solidarity, to make sure, like, everybody's on the up and up, you know? Like, that to me is an equivalent of what is happening, you know, or what was happening in the 19th century to what happens now when black men and women are sort of shaken down by the cops. That moment where you can be in solidarity with someone else.
Dr. Jackson, number one, how are you feeling?
I feel good.
You're all right?
I got a few more minutes in me. A few more minutes, at least 15 minutes for sure.
Great. I'm going to break it momentarily and ask you how you're feeling before we continue. And for the listening audience, we're in conversation with historian, author, and assistant professor of African studies at Wellesley College, Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson. And we're discussing the book, Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. In the beginning of the book, Dr. Jackson, you put a portion of a letter written by James McCune Smith, who was the first black physician here in this country. And he wrote it in August of 1856 and put it in Frederick Douglass's newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I want to read what he states for our listening audience. And he was referring to some of the August 1st celebrations that blacks would have, and they called Emancipation Day in reference to what had went on in Haiti. And there was a lot of celebrations around it in black communities, especially free black communities. They would have parades, food, bazaars, speeches, and things of that nature, similar to what whites would do on the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. But he wrote, what vexed McCune Smith the most was the notion that British emancipation had been a bond conferred rather than a right seized upon and held. Consequently, he mocked celebrants by mimicking an old 1848 minstrel song, Massa, Give Me a Holiday, where black Americans, hope for abolition as a gift from slave owners acting of their own free will. According to McCune Smith, freedom could not be bestowed. It had to be won. Violent upheaval was the order of things. teaching children to celebrate given freedom needed to stop, he insisted, as this is some kind of freedom worth having. Our freedom must be won, and the sooner we wake up to that fact, the better, he warned his readers. Harkening back to the electric feeling that inspired numerous slave rebellions, McCune-Smith subsequently praised leaders such as Denmark Vesey and Nat Turner and brave men and women who fought during the Christiana resistance of 1851. These violent acts effectively shed light on the future of black Americans, he contended. Our white brethren cannot understand us unless we speak to them in their own language. They recognize only the philosophy of force, he explained. According to McCune-Smith, expecting white Americans to embrace black humanity required physical engagement. They will never recognize our manhood until we knock them down a time or two. You know, hearing that from a portion of a speech or a written essay in 1856, and to me, it rings true even to this present day, because there's a lot of factors that's still involved that was involved then for our people. Talk about when you first came across that and how you felt in relation to what he was saying.
When I read that quote, I was like, so this is what I'm starting with. And I wanted to start with that because, I mean, it was so powerful. He was just like, we shouldn't be celebrating this. This is, you know, we're still in slavery. Like, this is not freedom for us. And this is not the kind of freedom you want to have. And so, you know, for me, it was a powerful way, I think, to talk about how we think about freedom, how we think about how we obtain freedom, and also how we think about this question that pops up over and over throughout the book is, how should oppressed people respond to their own oppression? And what do you do when you don't have the vote, when you're not a citizen, when you can't sort of go through the traditional channels of bringing about change? And so, when I saw that quote, it just struck me a lot. And it also made me think about how we understand not just violence, but self-assertion. Like when someone says, here's what you're not going to do, right? Like, mm-hmm. And, you know, how you let people know what you are willing to take and embrace. I think that's when you start to see real change happen. So in the 19th century, when slave catchers realized, oh, this is the deadliest catch. Like, I'm risking my own life in trying to retrieve these fugitive slaves. You know, it had them pause for a little bit. I think even if you fast forward, you know, into the 20th century, when you see these Klan attacks and they're attacking black communities, and black communities take up guns and fight back, and they say, if you shoot at my house, I'm gonna shoot at you, right? Like, those Klan activities, little by little, start to stop when they're faced with retaliation, when they're faced with a gun on the under end, on the other end of that window. And you see it happen in the Black Power Black Panther movement, when the Black Panthers picked up guns to use their Second Amendment rights. And keep in mind, like, the Black Panthers didn't shoot anybody. They're not killing up folks or, you know, going on a rampage. They're simply walking around saying, you know, this is my right to own a gun, right? To possess this, to protect myself. This is my constitutional right. And it's interesting that when that happens, it's the first time in California that you get real gun control legislation. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think when we think about change and, like, how these things come about, violence or force, I will say, because force is not necessarily violent, although violence is always forceful. Force is different. Force always compels people to act, to change, to pivot. More than any other thing that I have seen in history. I tell my students all the time, look at how we teach history. We go from contact, like settlement, the killing off of Native Americans, to the American Revolutionary War, more violence, to the Civil War, more violence, to World War I and World War II, more violence, to Vietnam to 9/11, like every major moment in history, we benchmark it through violence, mm-hmm. right? It's not, we don't have turning points on birthdays. You know what I mean? Like, that's not like how we move history along. We talk about history through violent upheaval. And so, and through that violent upheaval is how change is brought about. So there is no, you know, if you think about 9/11, a violent act happens, and now everything after that has a post 9/11 lens. If you look at World War II, everything after that has a post World War II lens or a post Vietnam lens. We understand that moment through the violence that took place. So, it's no different for Black people to think that white people would not understand them unless they use violence.
And one thing that I liked about in New York, as you do, no, and well, I heard in a discussion, maybe an interview, and somebody, you brought up the point about protective violence, because I think that mm-hmm. may be a uniquely American African perspective of the use mm-hmm. of violence, right? Mm-hmm, our mm-hmm. experience has not necessarily been an aggressive violence as yeah. others, but more from a protective perspective, the need for violence.
That's completely spot on. I mean, when I'm using the term protective violence, because I think it's broader than self-defense. So if it's self-defense, we think someone's coming at me, it's a very individual act, I'm going to protect myself. But this protective violence is really about how Black people and Black abolitionists or Black leaders protected not only themselves, but their families, their communities, oftentimes strangers. You know, they didn't know these fugitive slaves, and they were willing to risk their lives for them because they were trying to protect their humanity. So none of the violence that I talk about is ever about like out and out rebellion or people just sort of slitting their master's throats in this very like revenge fantasy way. It is almost always about protecting children, protecting fugitives, protecting Black communities, protecting Black churches or orphanages or businesses, protecting Black livelihood. And you see that even in the 20th century, you know, when we look at the Black Panthers, it was never about killing cops. It was about protecting the Black community from police brutality. So I don't think that, I'm not saying that Black people can't be violent, but I think that we need to rethink how we sort of give meaning to self-defense all throughout history, how Black people have constantly had to defend themselves physically, emotionally, psychologically, from white oppression, from white terrorism, from white supremacy. You know, we're constantly, I think, defending ourselves. And that's a really laborious position to be in. There's a lot of labor that's done in being on the defense like that all the time.
We got a couple calls here. Let's go to, hold on a second. Let me get this up here. Let's go to BTR and Scotty. Let's go. Scotty, are you there? Mm. Let's try this again. Scotty, BTR. Scotty?
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, good evening to you, Elliot and Richard, and to your guest tonight, Dr. Jackson. Dr. Jackson, I consider myself part of a new abolitionist movement that does not, it's not a matter of belief, but it's a matter of fact that the United States, through the 13th Amendment, did not abolish slavery. When you look at the UN Declaration of Human Rights, it talks about abolishing slavery in all its forms. So, you know, that international body recognized that slavery came in many forms. Now, mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass and let me say this about Lincoln. I don't even look at Lincoln as no abolitionist. People call him the great emancipator and all this. Look, this man was writing a slaver in Georgia, a Georgia congressman, telling them that upon his election, he was not going to interfere with their property, that, mm-hmm. you know, he just wanted the status quo. If we get new territories, which, you know, was the conquest of Native Americans' territory, but they just didn't want those territories to become, you know, slave territories, you know, hence John Brown in the border wars, you know, with Kansas, the mm-hmm. Kansas, what they call it, Bloody Kansas and mm-hmm. what happened. Mm-hmm. So I never looked at Lincoln as an abolitionist. And I think the 13th Amendment was a betrayal of every abolitionist that supported him. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, we know he, and then my contention is he only issued the Emancipation Proclamation because they were losing and they needed they needed them black soldiers. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, after the Emancipation Proclamation, Frederick Douglass said he called it a stupendous fraud. So my question is, in your research, did anybody recognize the language, the exception clause in the 13th Amendment and say that it's a stupendous fraud? Because, and I'm going to quote it, slavery and involuntary servitude shall be abolished except as a punishment for crime. And, and you know, how that got passed, I believe, was a compromise with the Confederates that you then bring in, you know, and then they get to vote on it. And here's the concession. You can't practice slavery in this form, but if you convict them of a crime, thus we get convict leasing and today what they call mass incarceration. So did any research, did any of the abolitionists during that time recognize the 13th Amendment as a stupendous fraud? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal question. And thank you so much for everything that you said. Is, you know, I'm nodding because I'm like, yes, that's, Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He would, you could ask him that and he would say, I'm not an abolitionist. Like, you know, everything that you're saying is spot on. My book stops right at the start of the Civil War. So I ended, I thought it was a great place to end the book with the start of the Civil War. But I will say that when black leaders are looking at the 13th Amendment, They are optimistic and disturbed at the same time. So in some ways, you can't underestimate the Emancipation Proclamation and the fact that 3 million of the 4 million people get freed, and the fact that the rest of them are freed in the 13th Amendment. And immediately the moment is, now I got to find my mom, now I got to find my brother, now I got to see if I can go back and find so-and-so. The first thing they're thinking is not, oh, if I steal a chicken, I could get 10 years in prison, right? Like, no one is thinking about that immediately. This is something that comes, the consequences of the 13th Amendment aren't felt immediately. So at first, it's elation, right? We're free. Let's find our family members. Let's get established. Let's put our kids in school. You know, all of the things that black people had hoped and desired for. It's only until several years after that, that you start to see the unraveling of these hopes and realizing, oh no, this is not exactly what we were promised. And you really start to feel that towards the end of the 19th century, where in 1890, black people are 12% of the population still, but 30% of the prison population. So 1 in 3 black people are incarcerated. You really start to feel the effects of that toward the end of the 19th century and especially all throughout the 20th and 21st century. So there are some people that were perceptive enough to say, this feels like a bad deal. But in that moment, people weren't necessarily thinking about the long-term effects or how this would play out. No one knew the future. No one knew that the South was pretty much going to get all their power returned to them. No one knew that Andrew Johnson was going to be a horrible successor to Lincoln. No one knew that Grant was also going to give up and pull all the troops out the South and say, well, black people are good. I don't think you need protection anymore. So people did not anticipate that. But when it happened, it became all the more clear that, yes, the 13th Amendment is incomplete or insufficient.
Let me go to another one. Let's go to 647. That's in Toronto. 647.
This is Norman. How you doing?
How are you, sir?
Hi.
Oh, I'd like to ask Dr. Carter. First of all, I've never seen it, but it's my understanding that there is a name, there's a street named after John Brown in Haiti. That's one comment. And secondly, there is a brother by the name of Kristen Lara, He is a filmmaker. He's based in France, but he is from Guadeloupe, and he has done very a huge number of films. And in his films, unlike the films that many of our people have made in the United States, in these films, they show men and women planning and executing slave revolts. And I've seen quite a few of his films, and you know they have the women planning and actually participating in the you know whole from stem mm-hmm. to stern. I mean, they kick butt and they get slain as well as the men. But the mm-hmm. question that I have, Christian Laurie is his name, and I think he's from mm-hmm. Guatemala. If you ever get a chance, check his films out.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I have for you is...
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead. I cut you off.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Martin R. Delaney, he wrote a book called Search for a Place, Black Separatism in Africa in 1860. And he went to Jamaica with a Jamaican brother by the name of Robert Campbell. And I basically just wanted you to talk about, you know, the role that Martin R. Delaney played, because, you know, they mm-hmm. talk about Martin R. Delaney. I guess he was kind of all over the place. He was.
He was in Liberia. Yeah. Well, first, let me answer your first question. You're absolutely right. I have been to Haiti. In Port-au-Prince, there is a street called John Brown. I took a picture of it. It's pretty cool to see. They love and respect John Brown in Haiti. So that's the first part. The second part is, yes, Martin Delaney was all over the world. He was huge separatist. He felt like, and, you know, I would say an early Pan-Africanist, right? He sort of preceded Black nationalism before it becomes what we know of it today. But he traveled all over the diaspora thinking about where can Black people be? Where can Black people live their best lives, basically? But it's interesting because for all the travels that Martin Delaney does, when the Civil War breaks out, he goes to one of his friends, Mary Ann Shedd Carey, who is a Black woman journalist in Canada. She'd also immigrated to Canada. She said, I'm never coming back to the United States. The United States can go kick rocks. I'm going to live my best life in Canada. And Martin Delaney goes to her and he says, no, you need to help me. We are at war. We need to recruit Black men to fight. Like, we need to fight for this country. Now that the war is here, we have a role to play. And so she joined him. They went all over the country recruiting Black men to fight in the Civil War. When they are able to fight in the war, Martin Delaney fights. He leads his own regiment. And it's interesting to me how, you know, there's this tension between fight or flight. Should we stay and fight and fight for what we believe to be ours, or should we just leave and go to Canada or go to Haiti or go to Jamaica or what have you? A lot of Black people chose to actually stay and fight. And Martin Delaney, for all of his travels, for all of his separatism, was a huge advocate of staying and fighting, and that's exactly what he did. So Alice Losing Good shows you that people are flexible, right? But when he saw an opportunity for Black people to maybe live their best lives right here in this country, he thought it would be best to fight for that, and he did.
Yeah, he lived in Toronto for a while.
He did. He lived all over. He's a native of Pittsburgh, though, so Pennsylvania really is his hometown.
He was a medical doc. He was a genius type of guy.
Yeah, Renaissance.
A doctor, mm-hmm. editor of newspaper. He was all over the map.
Yeah, intellectual. I mean, Renaissance man. I think he did it. He did it all. Martin Delaney is also another Black abolitionist that I just think gets overshadowed by Douglas. You know, everybody wants to talk about Douglas. And I love Douglas. Frederick Douglass is great. But there are also a lot of other people that do a lot of other things that don't get, I think, the kind of attention that Douglas gets.
Thank you for your call,
All
brother.
All right, thank you. Thank you.
Let's go to 602. 602.
Yes, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, good evening. And good evening to your guest, the good doctor.
Hey.
Doctor, I want to ask you a question. Being a historian and looking back, reflecting back, are there any parallels you can draw leading up to the Civil War and to the current situation that we live in? Are there any parallels in history that you can draw? And I'll mute my phone and listen to your response. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you for your call, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a good question. I see a lot of parallels. I think as historians, we are trained to see patterns, and we're trained to see themes that pop up over and over again. And when I think about the level of anti-blackness that we experience in today's society, the level of police brutality and mass incarceration and school segregation and the effects of racism in the health, public health industry. I mean, you pick an industry and black people are pretty much being oppressed. So, you know, I think in that way, I do definitely see that there are some successes and there's some progress that's been made, but there's also a lot more work to do. But the way I encourage my students is to sort of say that people like Lewis Hayden and Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney and William Parker, they would have killed to have the kind of resources that we have now. They were doing all of this activism before they were considered citizens, before they could vote, before they were considered free. And so today, you know, we have the opportunity to vote. Many of us do. We have the opportunity to boycott. We have the opportunity to use our dollars to use public shame to bring about the change that we want to see. And we can do it at all different kinds of levels, and we can do it pretty effectively and without violence, right? So I think in some ways I'm much more hopeful than I think the abolitionists would have been, because we have so many more tools at our disposal to help bring about change. I mean, I think if you were to talk to like Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman, and they were to see like the number of congresswomen, black congresswomen in Congress right now, and the House of Representatives right now, I mean, they would be shocked. If you were to see the number of, you know, CEOs or doctors or physicians or teachers, things that they would have thought impossible, really encourages me. So yes, I do see the parallels, but I'm also empowered because I realize that we have made a lot of progress, and then there are a lot of ways in which we can bring about even more change with our mouths, with our bodies, with our votes, with our pen. You know, for me, writing, publishing is a really powerful way, I think, to bring about change. There's so many ways in which we can contribute to making America the democracy we really want it to be.
Dr. Jackson, a question. Policing, as we know it now, especially militarized policing, and Scotty talked about it a few minutes ago, mass incarceration. To me, they're the children of the brutal chattel enslavement system that our ancestors lived under. If that is the case, then does the spirit of slavery, the system of slavery, still exist in this country?
Absolutely. There's a quote in the book by Joshua Easton. He says this in 1837, and I'm going to mention it. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it sounds so prophetic. He says, you know, we can attack slaveholding, but there's a danger still that the spirit of slavery will survive in the form of anti-blackness or in the form of black degradation, and that until we overthrow the spirit of slavery, it will always be with us, whether we abolish slavery or not. And that spirit of slavery he's talking about is really anti-blackness. And that, as I think, is what we're dealing with today. We've sort of effectively abolished slavery, but the spirit of slavery is still there, and it's reincarnated itself over and over again in the form of Jim Crow and in the form of police brutality, in the form of mass incarceration, where, you know, the effects of slavery or the effects of racism and anti-blackness are very much with us today.
And that's the hard work that we have to really go about undoing. Not so much the system of slavery itself, but, you know, how do you get someone to understand the how problematic racism is, right? How wrong it is for people of color. But equally important, how do you get white people to understand how racism hurts them, right? How racism is bad for them. That white supremacy is not a benefit. That's the real hard task. And that's what me and a lot of my colleagues are hard at work trying to do today, is to really overthrow the spirit of slavery.
Go ahead, Richard. Go ahead.
I just was, because in your reframing, I guess I'm an advocate, because, you know, and hearing how you're just reframing the narrative, right, the historical narrative, and giving black people a center in this. Because one thing that, you know, when we even talk about the Civil War or emancipation, and I think it came up indirectly in the discussion, you know, in the question and your response, we never really placed it that we were fighting for liberation as a people. Mm. And mm-hmm. even protective violence was a tool or policy that we generated in American experience to deal with liberation, you know? So somebody like Delaney, I think that y'all work in reframing in this, because until we take the take ownership of our own narrative that is different than white America, who has an aggressive violence compared to an attack, protective violence approach to social, political, and even economic relationship. Because one thing came into my mind as I was thinking about your book and whatever, now violence in America is what they call it, sanctions. How many people are being harmed by sanctions? How many children, whatever, being, that's an aggressive act of violence. We wouldn't have considered that, you know, when you're talking fighting enemy combatants. So us being able to take ownership of our narrative, but it has to be reframed out of the American, you know, the way America generally, especially in the academy, is projecting it. That's, I think that your work and others are really helpful in that.
Yeah, we need to do, I will say, you know, academics like myself, we need to do a better job of making sure that our books get to the public. You know, I think a lot of times historians write for other historians, they're writing for their field, and sometimes, you know, you read other people and you're like, what did they say? Does this make sense? What are they talking about? And, you know, and what I'm trying to do is, you know, and I hope I did, is to write a book that makes it plain, you know, that's easy to read, that's accessible, so that these ideas aren't stuck in the Ivy Tower, that they don't get stuck among academics and professors speaking at conferences, but that the broader public has access to these ideas and are thinking about these new narratives K through 12, you know, because let's face it, not everybody's going to college. These are things, these are concepts and narratives and ideas and people that need to be introduced K through 12. And that's, we need to make our work much more accessible, to get it into the textbooks, to get it into the children's books, you know, so that our kids can read about someone like Lewis Hayden or Eliza Parker, and that it's not foreign to them, or it's not something that they only get when they go to college, if they go to college.
Mm. Dr. Jackson, how do you feel?
I feel good, but I should probably wrap up. I should do
okay.
it on a high note.
You know what? I had so many other questions, and I wanted to go a little further with you. What we'll do, we'll schedule it another time.
I would love to come back. That would be great.
What month are you in? I'm just curious.
I am 4 months. I'm just getting
You're early.
Yeah, which is why I'm sick.
Okay.
So, but I'm hoping, you know, they say the second trimester is different. So I'm hoping to get that relief in the next week or so, but I do enjoy talking about the book and, you know, hearing people's questions, and it really invigorates me, because it lets me know that people care about this and are empowered by this, and it's it's always just really affirming for me.
You know, there's other areas that I want to kind of venture into, but I want you to email me when you feel up to it, because I'd like you to come back on and talk about how the black church felt about what was going on during that period. It's a lot of different areas that we can spin off on.
There's so much. There's still so much to talk about. There's still so much to be written, and not just by me, but by other up-and-coming scholars. I'm excited to see the work that other scholars are doing in this field. It's really exciting and inexhaustible, and that's, I think, is really good. There are so many different ways to talk about this, and religion is one of those aspects. So, yeah, whenever you want to have me, I would love to come back.
Great, great. I'll check with you maybe about a month, and maybe we can reschedule you.
Yeah, sounds good.
You know, before you go, Dr. Jackson, tell the people how they can purchase the book.
Yes. So if you if you are on Amazon, and I know a lot of people use Amazon, you can get the book for, I think it's $27 on Amazon. But you can also go to UPenn Press. The book is published with the University of Pennsylvania. UPenn Press has the book on sale as well. And if you put in the code PP20, that's P as in Paul, P as in Paul 20, you'll get an additional 20% off. So, and who doesn't like a good discount, right? So, UPenn Press, you can also get it at your local Barnes & Noble. I've been to Barnes & Noble now in New York and Philly and Chicago and seen my book there, which is pretty cool. So, and you can always ask them to order it if they don't have it. But pretty much everywhere books are sold, you can find Force and Freedom.
And
the paperback
should
be out next year. Yes, I'm excited for that too. Museums are stocking it. If you're here in Boston, they have it at the local African-American Museum. And I believe the paperback will be out in time for Black History Month. So that's exciting, too.
Okay. I'll be looking forward to our second part two of this conversation.
Yes. Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Now, take care.
We're going to take a
You as well.
We're going to take a brief break. And we'll be right back. We'll transition from the remainder of the program into open forum. So if you didn't get a chance to call in with our guests, you can give us a call, 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back. Time for an awakening.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP of the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I say that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He'll still be a Tom. You can put them anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Again, I want to thank our guest that was with us, spent about an hour and a half with us, historian, author, and assistant professor of African Studies at Wellesley College, Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson, was with us to talk about the book Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Richard.
Yes, yes.
That was an interesting discussion. I wanted to go further, and we will, because I know she'll come back. Couple of things I wanted to bring up, and I'll bring them up with you because you're familiar with that period of time. People go and get the book. The book is very interesting. The things that she documents in the book is things that Richard, this book can be taken and have discussions in churches, discussions among community groups, strategy discussions, because it's not only strategies of our ancestors that are contained in this book, or mindsets of our ancestors are contained in this book. It's also lessons of what has happened when some of these strategies were put to the people they were dealing with and the response of these Europeans. So it's an interesting period, and the book is very interesting. I'd recommend it. People get the book and use it as a book club book or whatever. Talk about what is seen there. Talk about some of our ancestors and what they envisioned, because it's an excellent point that you raise with her in reference to Douglas and some of the white abolitionists who was led by Garrison. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they had a falling out after the Civil War about the direction, when Garrison and it was basically saying, well, things is done now. You know, that was happening before the Civil War broke out. If that Civil War hadn't have broke out, Richard, and the whites hadn't start fighting over the profits from slavery, which caused that Civil War to break out, then that was eventually going to happen. Douglas was entertaining. In fact, that letter that was written by the doctor was in Douglas's paper. Douglas was already entertaining other thoughts from some of the black abolitionists that didn't go along with the stuff that Garrison and them was putting down.
Yeah, he was proposing to go ahead and look for immigration, being anti-immigrationist, looking for immigration route into Mexico and Haiti and other places right before the Civil War.
So you can see that they were headed towards a collision course anyway. It just happened that things got derailed when these whites in the North and South started fighting about who's going to come in as slave states and free states, and weird about the money. It's always been about money and profits for them. And when that war broke out, then all bets were off. So
but
then,
you know, go ahead. You know, excuse me, because I apologize, but it's just the thing that, and I think we was touching on it at the end. One thing that we're not seeing more crystally clear is that in that episode you talk about Douglas and Garrison, but even the conflict with Shad and Delaney, we were fighting for our own liberation.
Mm-hmm.
That's why black abolitionists view of what abolitionism is versus white abolitionists was so much different. And as she bring out, white abolitionists had, this here negative connotation of black people, even though they were fighting for liberation. Haven't really accentuated our position. You know?
Yeah, I agree. How did she term it? They were looking at it like a save the whales type of a thing.
Right.
And with our people, was their very lives. But the thing that pushed it to the brink, Richard, and then that's why I was saying that they were reaching a breaking point, and when that war broke out, that Fugitive Slave Act and the Dred Scott decision, both decisions by high governmental bodies, basically was pushing black people to the brink.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that these situations occurred where this war broke out. And that's why you see Delaney, Douglas, and others, Harriet Tubman, using that opportunity to rally black people. It wasn't about them saying, let's make America great. Let's free, whatever. It was about, let's take this opportunity to strike a blow for some type of freedom. They didn't know what it was going to be like, but they were going to take that opportunity. So they were going to go everywhere, like she mentioned. Go ahead.
And that was for freedom of enslaved people.
Exactly.
The distinction of leadership. They weren't looking at, they were already free, relatively. But their quest was to free all people.
Exactly. You know, I want to read this quote here that Douglas mentioned after this Fugitive Slave Act was enacted, and she wrote it in her book. But Douglas said, the only way to make the Fugitive Slave Law a dead letter is to make about a half dozen or dozen of these kidnappers dead. the man who takes the office of a bloodhound ought to be treated like a bloodhound. So this was a mentality that was taken over Douglas and several of the other black abolitionists. They was reaching the break at their point with, listen, this ain't working with these people. They don't understand any type of moral suasion.
Mm.
And that's not a racist statement. That's a factual statement.
Mm-hmm.
She comes up with that conclusion in her books based on some of the communications and the letters that some of our ancestors was going back and forth with. Our people weren't stupid. They knew what they were up against, and their lives was at stake. That's why they had to carry around guns, and, you know, that's why she said that she made that pistol on the part of the cover of the book important, because that was that's what they had to use. Harriet Tubman carried one, and they were prepared to use it.
And it's you know, and so the other thing that comes up is the internal. And I think we really, in order to propagate, I guess I'm be constantly beating that drum, you know, because what I hear us a lot of times doing, and I'm not talking about what we do here at Time for Awakening, we accentuate the white narrative, which by doing that, and even in their supposedly freedom talk or democracy talk or whatever, it brings out the contradiction because it isolates African people's presence, right? And so one thing that structurally, you know, I think we need to take the lesson is those conventions gave us the opportunity to be able to deal with those issues. Because one person I wanted to bring up the how she looked was Garrison. Is it not Garrison? Garnett, Henry Highland Garnett.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he said resist, for the reasons that you and he was talking to the slave community, the enslaved community, like, look, you know, and he's later, but he's saying, like, look, this enough is enough. They're not going to change. Let's take this to the next level.
Exactly.
That's my interpretation, you know, but that's something that was debated within the convention itself. And the reason why I'm saying it, because we need to look at history of to give us examples. Where do we see, and we hear organizations having conventions, but where do we see different positions, a structure where we come together and debate and enunciate what is it, the way we see our plight within the system of white hegemony? We don't have that. Kevin, when was the last conventions we had? I believe they were in the 60s and 70s. So how are we, you know, when we talk about leadership, we're talking about leadership in a structure that, as, you know, Scotty self bring up, they came together, and this was before black elected officials were able to get those positions in the South as congressmen, whatever. 13th Amendment came up. This was amongst white congressional people, knowing the South had a lot of the Senate positions, you know, so the Senate provided the opportunity for the South to, where the congressional people of the North had to, what, negotiate. Other than the bill wouldn't have got passed. You know, the Congress has proportional representation as a populist body. The Senate, you get two senators for each state. And it was more Southern states, or at least more states that supported enslavement, even if they weren't hardcore states.
Certainly. Yes, certainly. You're absolutely right. It's a real interesting period because it's a lot of lessons that can be learned and utilized now, because the white establishment uses the same formula, Richard. It hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
The same methods, the same, sure, it's modernized, but the basic methods that was used haven't changed. I think that our attitude towards them has definitely changed. It's more it's more acceptable. It's more lenient. It's more, well, I hope things will be different. You know, we haven't been learning from some of the lessons of history, and a lot of those lessons of history have been denied. The perspectives of it have been denied. That's why she wrote this book.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the, you know, what's the difference in, you know, you touch on it all the time with about Black leadership, whether it's church leadership or political leadership, that the leadership then, or what is considered leadership, those men and women, they were speaking for the voice of Black people. Enslaved, regardless of their class, that they were representatives of people. It didn't, you know, they weren't trying to represent the government. They weren't trying to represent the company. They weren't trying to represent their class structure, even though maybe some of that might have went on. But they weren't, I mean, when you look at those in the articles that they wrote in the Black newspapers of the time, they were talking about freedom as it relates to all Black people, those who are free and those who are enslaved. Do we have that kind of leadership speaking with that kind of voice today?
No, not these folks. And that was before the era of political representation. I'm not even talking about the early Black politician. That's totally different. You're talking about some of the abolitionists who was basically a Black politician of that era. That wasn't in an elected form, so to speak. And these men and women were dedicated, Richard, because when they had these Black conventions, and you know it because a lot of their work and tours and everything that you do is centered around this. When they were in different locations, whether it be Philadelphia, Boston, New York, or different cities, it wasn't like, I mean, keep in mind, and I know our people realize this, there were no planes at that time. And train travel was relatively new. It was basically carriage, horse, or you walk. In a lot of our cases, when our ancestors went north, they was running. So, you know, this was travel in itself back then was a challenge. And then you're on the road, you don't know who you're going to run into. Mm-hmm. And especially after that feud, they could come up north and grab you, and you could have been born in Pennsylvania, born in New York. It doesn't matter. So they were jeopardizing their lives even traveling to these conventions. It was a whole different dynamic that we have to put in to the mindset of these ancestors, be it men or women. They had a whole different mindset and approach to our people that our people don't have. That love and care, that deep love and care, we got to get that back as a people.
And I just always feel to emphasize, and those delegates, they didn't just on their own say, I'm a leader. It was the community. I mean, they had discussions within the community themselves that even sent representatives to represent. So it wasn't like I just popped up and said, I'm a Black leader.
Okay.
You know what I mean? There were discussions within the community itself that they came represent them. Now, they had their own point of view, but the people were a part of that position. Those could be a part of that. I think that's an important lesson now, because people are talking about we're voting for this person, voting for that person. But how close is that person to you? And how much do y'all have any discussion at that local level to say what is the point of view you supposed to be representing to wherever you go, whether you go to a Black convention or whether you go to a ward position or a council position or a Congress position? You supposed to be taking this voice with you. Not you decide I'm going to run today and all I got to do is get enough money from anybody. And, you know, all I got to do is get enough of y'all to vote for me. And I ain't even got to talk to y'all until I'm ready to get y'all to vote, to tell you to come out to vote for me. And then that's it. That's not representing your view. And, you know, that's not leadership, even though it's part of an organization, you know, to me, that's the lesson we can get out of those 19th century leaders, that abolitionists of that time.
You know, not to change the subject, but you know, we talked about what kind of brought this thing on a collision course. That war kind of threw everything into a frenzy, for not only for black folks but for white. And it was all over greed and profits from slavery. It had nothing to do with their moral, slavery is wrong. We did this to black folks for hundreds of years. Let's correct this wrong. It had nothing to do with it. And the reason I'm saying this, I ran across this article, and it just goes back to the origins of this. Look, check this out, Richard. Now, this is from the New York Times. It says Colt suspends production of the AR-15 rifle for customers. On Thursday, the maker Colt said on Thursday it would effectively suspend production of sporting rifles, including AR-15s, for the civilian market, but continue to manufacture rifles for government weapons contracts. In a statement on the website, Colt emphasized that the company remained committed to the Second Amendment, but cited market conditions for its decision. Over the past few years, the market for modern sporting rifles has experienced significant excess manufacturing capacity, says Dennis Villiers, the company's chief executive, in a statement. Given this level of manufacturing capacity, we believe that there's an adequate supply of modern sporting rifles for the foreseeable future. If there's a market demand, he said, I'm sure there are other companies with the capacity to fill it. The AR-15 military-style weapon has been used in several recent mass shootings, including Newtown, Connecticut, Orlando, Florida, and Parkland, Florida. So we see here that the AR-15 that's produced by Colt, they said that they were going to suspend it for public sales. And you know, that means selling it in Walmart and whatever, over the counter. I'm quite sure you'll probably still be able to get it at shows. And plus, they said they're going to still provide it for government sales.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look back, Richard, this Colt, this manufacturer, check this out. Now, Samuel Colt, born in July 19th, 1814, in Hartford, Connecticut, and died in 1862 at the age 47. Occupation, inventor, industrialist, businessman. His net worth at the time of his death was $15 million. Now, that's at the time of his death then, $15 million. Now, this is a couple paragraphs, but just check this out. Samuel Colt was an American inventor and industrialist from Hartford, Connecticut. He founded the Colt Patent Firearms Manufacturing Company, now known as Colt Manufacturing, and made the mass production of the revolver viable for the first time. Colt's first two business ventures ended in disappointment. His first attempt at manufacturing firearms in Paterson, New Jersey, occurred during an economic crisis in the U.S., leading to poor sales, and was further hampered by Colt's mismanagement and reckless spending. His next attempt at firearm manufacturing underwater mines for the U.S. Navy failed due to lack of U.S. congressional support. After the Texas Rangers ordered 1,000 of his revolvers during the American War with Mexico in 1847, his business expanded rapidly. His factory in Hartford built guns used as sidearms by both the North and South in the American Civil War, and later his firearms were credited with taming the frontier West. A second plant was opened in London. Colt died in 1862 before the end of the Civil War. He was one of the wealthiest men in America. The company is still in business today. Elizabeth Jarvis Colt commissioned the building of the Church of the Good Shepherd. Well, okay, whatever. If you went into religion. But what I'm saying is, Richard, this man made firearms and sold them to both the North and South. Now he was he was Connecticut. He was a Yankee, the term they used. Mm-hmm. But he didn't care. It was about money to him. His mentality was a European mentality. Mm-hmm. He didn't say, well, listen, what they're doing is wrong. I'm going to sell this weapon to the North so we can defeat the South. He said, no, I'm going to sell both North and South and make millions of dollars during that period. He didn't care. He did not care. That's what all of that was about. Don't let this narrative fool you. Like you said, Lincoln's an abolitionist. He cared about blacks, all this other crap. It was all about the profits from slavery and white folks wanting more money than the next white person. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, no, no. I was just thinking, you know, as you read that and said, because the other side of it, both of those, and we have to look at it as two governments. It was governments that were using money, as do today, our tax dollars, finance these kind of companies. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, here we are complaining about the effect that they have, but at the same time, the money that we're giving them, supposedly looking out for our general welfare, is supporting our own death and destruction on the street. What was that? The U.S. something marshals or the first group of sales that Samuel Coote was able to get was that federal marshals that bought those guns, the Colt 45 or
yeah, what does it say here? The Rangers, Texas Rangers. Well, right, it was a governmental agency. Purchased 1,000 of the 45s, the revolvers.
You know, so all along, the government has been financing the gun manufacturing company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the like anything else, where do we see any benefit from that?
Wow. You know what? He had a marketing slogan. Let me read this because it kind of culminates the European mentality and their feelings towards weapons. It says this was his marketing slogan the company's marketing slogan in 1873. Be not afraid of any man, no matter what his size. If danger threatens, call on me. And I will equalize. God made man, but Samuel Coate made him equal. So, you know what I'm saying? If danger threatens, call on me. And he ain't talking about no call on guy. He talking about call on that gun. And I will equalize. Mm-hmm. God made man. Samuel Coate made him equal. That was his marketing slogan.
Right.
For guns. That's what I was saying before. All this, you know, come on. This symbol of the United States with the eagle with the talon in his wings. Come on. It should be a gun. It should be a picture of a gun. Maybe a Colt or early weapon. I don't care whether it's a musket, Colt 45, whatever. A gun, it should be the symbol of this country. Because that's what they use to vanquish other people and commit worldwide genocide. Come on. That's the reality of the situation.
Another important point that you raised out of the article that we usually don't get to hear is that chief executive officer, you know, Dennis Volex or whatever, how you say his name. And I apologize for messing.
Yeah, I probably butchered it too.
Yeah. But the point is, these people make these kind of decisions, you know, and what is it that we have? What influence do we have? But what is the impact of their decision on our lives? You know, and that's the, because a lot of time we're talking about the gun or the name of the company, but it's a real person sitting in that seat.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's going after them. Just like when these here officers, they're talking about the police, but that's a specific officer. And the question is, why is he or she there? I mean, you know, like I've been looking at that. I don't want to get vulgar, that babe that's up there on the seat now for killing of the person in Texas. She crying.
Oh, now. The one that just gave a little CPR after she shot the man. I don't know how do you give a little CPR, Richard? I mean, what is that? How do you what? Huh?
And when the question is, well, who are you thinking about when you stepped out the room? Was you thinking about him or yourself? Well, you know, I mean, it's just, but the thing was that got me early in the week around that was the position the judge, like the district attorney comes to it and, you know, like they wasn't supposed to have no, TV or do any public announcement about the trial. And then it comes up to the judge, who's a black female, that they went on and disobeyed that letter of not having any outside influence. And how she had to contain herself. I mean, the woman had to bend down, turn to the side. I guess she cussed her out. She didn't want to, you know, and come back. The blatant disregard for black life and the immediacy of utilizing these guns to deal with something. And going back to what, Dr. Jackson says, our position was a protective violence. To me, that's something that we need to, you know, look at. I ain't out here to try to kill you, use my gun to hurt you. But if you come, I got to protect myself.
Yeah, but see, you're talking about it. And see, that's what is touched on in this book, and not really touched on it. It talks about it, but it talks about it not directly. She didn't, in the book, she don't write to talk about the mentality that they were dealing with, but it comes out. Mm-hmm. For example, you talked about the protective violence that blacks are talking about. Even that quote that I read from Douglas, when he said, because of this fugitive slave law, he said, what black folks need to do is take down 5 or 10 of those ones that try to enact that law, coming after people. Mm-hmm. And you know that quote I just read.
Right.
So
right.
They're not talking about, okay, you did this Fugitive Slave Act. We're going to wait for Sunday and go into a Catholic church and just shoot up the place. Or go into one of your farmers, and I'm trying to use venues at that period. Go into one of your farmers markets where I know that white folks are shopping, and just take some machetes or hand pistols and unload on them. They weren't talking about that. They were always talking about protecting themselves, their families, their women, and their loved ones, their property, and others that was innocent. But with whites, it was always different. Their mentality, the way they're looking at these things is totally different. And it hasn't seemed to change over the centuries. I'm not talking about over the decades or the past 5 years or couple of years or from presidency to presidency. They don't have nothing to do with it. I'm talking about over the course of hundreds of years since we've been here. I'm not even talking about before we came to these shores, because they're mentality before they came to these shores was bordering on barbarism. Mm-hmm. They've tried to clean up their act since they've been here in the West. And that's it. Listen, people might not like those type of things being stated, but that's true. All you have to do is look at history. They have tried to clean up their act since they've been in the West and formed a United States. The image has tried to be cleaned up and more palatable for people to accept. But before they came to these shores, everything was bordering on barbarism and what they were doing and how they were dealing with other people. So, you know, that's the reality of the situation that our people were faced with when they were during the early stages of dealing with this man. It's really incredible that our people were able to survive those periods, Richard. The fortitude of our ancestors, we've been through everything. And still fighting, and still here.
With all this madness going on.
And she mentioned, and I think somebody interviewed her in reference to the book, and she tried to relate some of these things to what's going on now. She kind of touched on it in her, and when she was talking here, and she mentioned about Kaepernick and what he did, and it referred to different movements that black people do now and how they can adopt and employ some of the strategies of the black abolitionists. But if you don't know any of those strategies or who those men or women were or what they tried to do, then how can you adopt any of their strategies? Mm-hmm. You'd be reinventing the wheel when it's not really necessary. You educate yourself to what they were doing, because just like I said, these European strategies against black people haven't really changed. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe you can point out how it's morphed or changed. Or, I mean, sure, the times are more modern. But, you know, am I wrong?
It seems to me that, you know, the question you raised and the perspective you raised, that's why I raised the point about these whole thing of sanctions, because now that's the aggressive gun. You know, when you're talking about you don't create a situation where the countries import somewhere all the basic needs instead of supplying it for themselves. And you look at the continent of Africa, you look here when we talk about food deserts, and then they're going to create sanctions in order to try to change the government or overthrow the government. But who is actually getting killed? Is that not an aggressive? Is that any different than going in with some guns?
No, it's not. It's just that you're not there. It's just that you're not there personally to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But sanctions and the use of drones. Now they'll send a drone in and kill 30, 40. Just like a couple of weeks ago, they killed, I think, 30 or 40 mm-hmm. farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Innocent people, and it was collateral damage. It was a push of a button or whatever that caused this robot to blow these people up or shoot a missile that blew these people up. They weren't there to do it physically, but it's basically the same thing.
So, no, yeah, and that's why I'm emphasizing that those two points about liberation and protective violence, because those are things that come out of the American experience, but only affect the Africans in America. You know, we had to come up with a way of not to survive, to live in this hostile environment, a principle and tactics to live in this hostile environment that's unique to our experience. The Irish immigrants didn't have to deal with that to that degree. The German immigrants didn't have to deal with it to that degree. They didn't have to deal with an onslaught of continuous violence, free or unfree. They didn't have to deal with the economic violence that came. They didn't have to deal with uncertainty of space and place. So everybody else can say about, and they weren't here as long. When you talk about free Africans or enslaved Africans, these other people, they come in shiploads over time, and we get pushed to the side, and in the narrative of history, we get written out of it. I mean, as she said, those young scholars may be trying to, you know, and it's not a lot of them. They may be trying to do the work of it, but when you read the works of a lot of these historians, they have, I mean, even enslavement becomes something mentioned more than something central. We make it central.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Or are we supposed to?
Mm.
Supposed to be always in the forefront, just like in the clip that the collage. The black thought and black understanding should be always paramount.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what else should we be thinking? I mean, who else should we be looking out for?
And we have this kind of, I mean, it should be, and it's not. And as she said, these are the narratives that should be going on really, not just from K to 12 or whatever, but from the womb to the tomb. And until we do, we don't take ownership of our position and place. How can you strategize? How can you assess your vision if you ain't centered in your own history? Even if it's incomplete as an individual, like, you know, a lot of times I don't remember the specific names, but if we have some understanding, at least we can have some dialogue, or those, you know, like it's for like that, Dr. Jackson, who can be able to, or some of the call, all the callers that call in, actually clarify. That helps our dialogue. You know, she mentioned the woman Amelia R. N. Robertson, who was speaking about the, you know, the caning of Charles Sumner. Mm-hmm. She could have went in, like this woman. She called the person out. She said, "This is a woman in New Orleans. You need, you know, if you want to beat up on somebody, come beat up on me." And she put in her opinion, her name. She like you, you basically you ain't nothing but a. It's in the book.
Yeah, I know it.
You know. So this kind of understanding fortifies us, I just believe. But if we don't have it, then we're always not clear of what is it that we're actually trying to achieve, and we don't know how to assess the tactics that we have. Because when we talk about youth violence, black on black, if we had what she was saying, you know, about Christiana, about the Elise and William Parker, if we had protection societies in our community, would these young boys be running around killing each other?
I know it. And that's the lessons that we can learn, or some of the things. Because if you're talking about those protection societies and things like that, we had it during that period. And the violence is still present now, and especially from outside forces and now from inside forces. Those mm-hmm. things are needed. And like you stated before about the narrative of these things being changed, that's another thing that's really important, because media is very powerful. And if we don't try to control these narratives or try to put out other forms of information to counteract some of these narratives, then our young people will get trapped. A lot of them don't understand what's going on. They don't understand that some of these media people and the people that they put in front of them are not in their best interest. But if we do, then it's important for us to put out a counter narrative to what's going on. One of the things, the reason I mentioned this before we start winding down, a couple weeks ago when we were talking about this thing about Jay-Z and them coming forward with this Reform Alliance, and Jay-Z was involved. He pulled in the Meek Mill, Robert Kraft, owner of the 76ers, and others. And that's what led to that contract with the NFL and things of that nature. All of it was interrelated. Now, Jay-Z and them supposedly got involved, supposedly, from what I understood, because he was in support of Kaepernick, which was only a strategy that his group employed, and a lot of these whites that are involved with him, but that was used as a tactic. Now, when they presented that Reform Alliance as a initiative, they had everybody get up and speak to why they were involved. And a lot of it, the song and dance that went on. You still there with me, Richard?
Yeah,
a lot of the song and dance that went on, but I want you to hear just a little brief clip on to why he said that he was involved and Van Jones, because they kind of culminate at the end of why they're involved. Now, yeah, well, let me play it, and then you just get your own assessment of what's being stated, if I can get this up here.
One's free. You think about the idea of growing up in a single parent house, which I grew up in, which me grew up in, and having an adverse feeling for authority, right? Your father's gone, so you're like, I hate my dad. Well, nobody tell me what to do. I'm the man in the house. And then you hit the street and you run into a police officer, and his first thing is, put your hands up, freeze, shut up. And you're like, excuse my language, everybody. You're like, fuck you. Right? So that that interaction causes people to lose lives, right? We don't want people that's in charge of the police areas to be in danger either. We want to be very clear. I don't want anyone to feel defensive about what I'm saying. I'm just saying the honest truth. And the people that are here today and the politicians that are here today know it's the truth. That's why they're here. And it's a humane issue, right? So if we are broken the family structure in one culture, it affects everyone. It affects that police officer who has to go home to their kid. It affects, you know, people who are raising kids and working really hard and have to pay taxes. And then, you know, we're housing people in jail for...
Now, Richard, before I play Van Jones, now, Jay-Z was basically putting this on young black folks.
Right.
This interaction with the police. Right. Because of broken family structures in one segment of the community. That's what he stated.
Mm.
And before he, you know, usually, you know, they like to keep it real. So, you know, when they call black women the B word, whores and bitches and everything else, they're keeping it real. But when you're in front of a white audience, why do you have to apologize when you say fuck the police?
Mm-hmm.
He turned and apologized before he made his statement. And excuse itself for being offensive. But he's keeping it real.
The whole narrative is you know, to be support that we're the ones that are creating the police to react that the way they react.
Exactly. That's what's stated here. That's what he's saying. I'm not putting the words in his mouth.
Man.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
Now let me play with Jones, why Jones is involved. And his is a little more brief than Jay-Z, but I'm going to play this.
Incredible amounts of time.
And so we want to put ourselves in a long line of freedom struggle, going back to the enslavement, going back to the days when women couldn't vote, going back to the days when LGBTQ folks were disrespected and continue to be disrespected. Those freedom struggles, those struggles for human dignity and human freedom are what we build on with this alliance.
Okay. Now, he said that that's what that alliance is about.
Mm-hmm.
Women's struggles, LGBTQ struggles when they were oppressed, and a black struggle. So all of that is like put together. Mm-hmm. That's why they're doing it. But notice the LGBTQ is involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
See, we got to look behind. You pull the cover off the wizard, pull that drape back, and see the little guy behind that's pulling these levers. Let me get one call, and then we call it night, Richard. Let's go to 215. 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, how y'all doing?
How are you, sir?
All right, now.
Yeah, I was actually at car right at 8 o'clock when Dr. Jackson was. I wanted to talk to Dr. Jackson, but that's cool though, because like I dug what the sister was saying, because like I said, she definitely did a due diligence, because I mean but I'm gonna get the book off of Amazon and stuff, Force and Freedom, because it's an excellent book, and I take it, Brother Ellen, Brother, the sister is expecting, and. I pray to Allah that she has a nice, healthy baby. She eats right. She take care of herself. And I definitely look forward to y'all have on again, okay, Ellen Richard?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sister was dynamic, man. I mean, she definitely did her homework and stuff, man. From what she says and from what y'all was saying, it's an excellent book and stuff. So I'm definitely going to get the order copy of the book. You know, Bill, I know y'all pressed for time, but, you know, on a few things on Jay-Z, you know, like you said, Ellie, you know, these guys never cease to amaze me. When they get in front of white folks, all of a sudden they learn their manners and politeness. But he got no problem, like you said, calling black women the B word, the brothers the N word, and all that stuff. When he come to white people, also he got excuses, something for saying the F you or whatever. You know what I mean? These Negroes, they kill me with that slave mentality. Jay-Z ain't nothing but an old handkerchief head, bootlicking Negro. When you pull off all the covers, him, Meek Mills, all the y'all's fuckies are the white man. They can slice any way they want to. Even my man Michael Corden said in the column in the Tribune the other week that Jay-Z ain't nothing but old sellout Negro. And stuff, and it's basically what it crazy because he's doing it. He don't even need the money. He just been out and out sellout and stuff. This is all he caught. And see, they slick because they him and Beyonce bailing people out of jail, but at the same time they making money off those ankle bracelets and stuff. You know what I mean? See, so you give me one, you throw me a hand, but you taking a hand back, so to speak. You know what I mean? These Negroes, boy, they got to call these Negroes out for who they are. And Ellen Richard, let me say this to y'all brothers. Yesterday on the Terrestrial Radio Show, our esteemed congressman, Evans, he was on there with that BS yesterday talking about some with the impeachment, telling some, yeah, well, you know, we showing the world that we're going to hold this president accountable. He not getting away with this. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And then at the end, he going to sit there and say, then he had the covers behind, so he got up there and said, well, you know, don't expect nothing major to happen anytime soon, and just don't get your hopes up too high. He went through all this here spill about how they going to hold him accountable, but then at the end, he going to sit there and put a qualifier on it and stuff, a disclaimer. Well, don't get your hopes up too high. I said, yeah, really?
Wait a minute, Joe. Why would black folks' hopes should be up anyway in reference to any of these administrations or Trump or anybody? Why would your hopes be up? If your hopes is up high in reference to what these people are doing, then you got more problems than any Donald Trump.
Yes. Because like you said, Ellie, they have all been bad to black people. Because like I say, these people, that they've used black people for a wash rag, and a poor black, sorry black leadership has let it happen. Because like I said, this gentrification all over Philadelphia and all over the United States, it couldn't happen unless they had black participation. And you see Kenyatta Johnson, this councilman, he's been investigated right now. He's one of the key persons that helped these white boys that you know, with these gentrification and everything. And check this out. I was told by a reliable source today, and this brother usually don't say nothing unless he has his facts straight. You remember the white boy that got killed last year that attacked the brother and stuff?
The young man that was on. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard that it was deeper than what we think. When I say deeper, I'm talking about the crime itself. I'm talking about Kenyatta's relationship with this guy. From what the brother told me, Kenyatta had pulled some strings to help get this white boy all kinds of deals and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know.
Well, that's not surprising. I mean, that ain't surprising.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not surprising. But see, we knew he had did it for one of his boys and stuff, but he had did it for this white boy, this slain white boy. He had did it for him as well. See, these Negroes, man, they just all they do is get in these offices and they continually, you know, be corrupt, doing things against the interests of their own people. That's why you got to, you know, these Negroes are a disgrace, man. But we can continue out of ignorance and being politically uneducated and stuff. Because like you said, knowledge is powerful. We keep electing these same sorry Negroes over and over again, and we wonder why the conditions of our people don't change, the conditions of our communities don't change. Because people like the Kenyattas, the Dow Clarks of the world, and on the national level, the John Lewis's of the world. I mean, these people, and I'm going to tell you something who they're hyping up right now, Elliot. And so we know Cory Booker don't stand a snowball in hell chance of being president. But somebody that they definitely hyping up, I think Brother Jay might have mentioned a while ago, because I know even some of the white politicians, even on the conservative, they've been mentioning his name. It's Hakeem Jeffries from New York. He's a Negro that they hyping up. I guess he's going to be the future Barack Obama, so to speak. So he's somebody you got to watch for, because they're going to prop him up as some kind of leader in the black community, or they hand up an old handkerchief head Negro itself, you know. Because I heard him, you know, talk out of both sides of his mouth on several occasions. I trust him as far as I could throw him, you know. But we remember that, Ellen Richard, Hakeem Jeffries, that's somebody going to definitely stop as we get past this election, after the 2020 and I guess after 2024, whoever wins or whatever, whether Trump gets back in or whoever, Biden or whomever getting in, you're going to hear her name, Hakeem Jeffries, mentioned more and more because he's one of them Negroes, and he's pro-Israel, as you know, Ellen Richard. He never seen a Zionist he didn't like, so that's one of the reasons why they pumping him up so tough.
Well, he would be a safe Negro to use, and he would be one that they would generally use, because if you notice anybody else that had affiliations with somebody that they deem as a negative, then they're going to bring it up and make you disavow that person. And if you notice, they haven't brought up Dr. Jeffries' name. Anytime you hear Hakeem Jeffries mentioned, they never bring it up.
It's true.
And they don't like the things that Dr. Jeffries has done or said over the years, or even what he represents.
Mm-hmm.
But his name is never mentioned, because I think that you know, it's clear that they got other plans for him, and it would be beneficial to him if they could use him and use as a backdrop his family, his association with his family.
Oh, I agree.
That would really be beneficial to white America to be able to use somebody like that.
I agree, because you know, because right now I think he's in the he's a high rank. He's on one of the Congress or Senate committees, whatever. I think he's a congressman.
He's a congressman.
Yeah. They say he's on one of the ranking committees and stuff that's supposed to be dealing with foreign affairs or something to that. I forgot exactly what it was. But, yeah, he's somebody that he's a perfect tool to use and stuff like that. See, like you said, L.A., when you play that clip of that sister during the interlude, when she says you can pick Uncle Tom, he's Uncle Tom, whether he's in the White House or anywhere else. Well, that's one thing about white folks, that you got to give it to them. They know how to pick these Negroes out, whether they male or female, conservative or so-called liberal. They know how to pick these individuals out, man. It's just they can find them. It could be a million black folks and stuff. I mean, it's pretty much a million black folks scattered in one place, and they'll direct right on that Uncle Tom or that Negress and stuff. I mean, they know how to do it, man.
They plan it out. I mean, we should be doing the same thing.
I agree.
They plan out who's going to lead your community. They know that guys like John Lewis, Jim Clyburn, and all these other people are elders.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're on their way out. Their political career is winding down.
Sure.
Just like, what's the name that was up there in Michigan?
John Conyers.
John Conyers. They know that these guys are, and they got to cultivate somebody that they can control for the next 20 years.
That's true.
So good now you see this new crop popping up.
Mm-hmm.
And some black folks are excited. This and that. But see, they don't realize it's a puppet master behind the scenes that's bringing these people to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like I say, you ever notice whenever you get a black person in office that really fights for black people? I mean, think about it. Look at the history. History is your best barometer to judge things. Whenever you got any black politician that truly was not afraid of the white man and fought for their people, that was unapologetically pro-black, they found a way to get rid of them. They got our people to be stupid, and that's what it was, because they get voted them out of office. I'm starting first with Adam Clayton Powell and stuff, who the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said support, because he said he's not afraid of the white man. What happened? They put some house Negro up like Charles Rangel and ignorant black people, and their self-hatred go along with it, and they vote the brother out of office. Same thing with Cynthia McKinney, his sister that had no problem standing on that congressional floor and condemning Israel's for their racist behavior, right? And what did the Negroes do? They voted out of office and stuff. So any black politician that truly loved their people, the white man put some Negro up there to get them out of office, and our people in their ignorance, they go right there and go right along with it. They go vote for some Negro who they know ain't nothing but a Negro and vote against the sister or brother that's been out there fighting for them, that's been unapologetically pro-black. Same with the brother in D.C., Marion Barry. Now, we all know Marion had his issue with drugs. And Minister Farrakhan said, he said, Brother Barry, you know, take a little, you know, after he went through his drugs, they said, Brother, take some time off, get yourself together, because I know you love our people, but, you know, we're not in a position to represent our people, because you got to deal with that substance abuse. But he said, once Brother Barry gets yourself together, come on back. And he's seeing what happened. And Marion Barry went on and got to, he became mayor again once or twice, two more times, and a councilman and stuff like that. Because Marion Barry, even in his drug weakness, he still had his love for his people. That was just a personal weakness he had. But he still had a love for his people, because I know for a fact he got my eye, God rest her soul, he got mine a civil service job up there when my Aunt Frances was able to retire on, because of Marion. Not only my aunt, many black folks up there, that's how they became so in the so-called black middle class up there, because of Marion Barry. He opened up doors to make sure that black folks got those high-paying jobs up in D.C. He looked out for his people. You know what I mean? We got to start supporting individuals like that that really got the interest and love of their people at heart. Because if we don't, we are doing, Brother Elliott, doing ourselves a disservice. You know, at the end of the day, we're doing ourselves for this service, man. Because these Negroes, they're like the Dow Clarks of the world and the Kenyatta Johnson, the Curtis Jones, them Negroes ain't looking out for the interests of black people. They're looking out for themselves, their own cronies, and to play footsies with white folks. That's all they're worried about. They ain't looking out for our people, man. Because like you said, you got to get them, you got to damn near get them, embarrass them Negroes when the police shoot or hurt a sister or brother. You got to get them, you got to shame them like Ace and them did in this city. They're the shame Dow Clark to come out and make a statement when that white cop shot David Jones in his back a couple years ago. Were it not for Asa and them shaming him, he would have never said a word, Ellie. You know it, man. You know what I mean, Ellie Richard? He wouldn't have said a word. He had to embarrass him in front of Kenny and city council for that nigga to say something. He wasn't going to say nothing. You know?
Thank you.
I mean, it's just amazing, man. But anyway, I know y'all brothers trying to get out and wind it down. But y'all enjoy a good show tonight. And like I said, Ellie and Richard, get Sister Jackson back again, Dr. Jackson, because she was dynamic. And like I said, I pray the sister take care of herself, she eat right, and God bless her for a healthy a child, man, because she's a dynamic sister, man. I really enjoyed the interview y'all had with her tonight. I really did.
Peace.
Thanks, Brother Elliott. Thanks, Brother Richard. Right.
Richard, come to the end of another program, man. Before we go, I want to go over the lineup again. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting dialogue on African Perspectives with Brother Oshie from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Time for an Awakening Media. Afterwards, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin and Jones from 1 to 3 on Time for an Awakening Media. From 6 to 8 on Monday evenings, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's 6 to 8. On Time for an Awakening Media. This Monday, oh no, it's the 30th. So it's the first and third Monday of every month. Inkoba's program, a reparations program, is on from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. And from 10 to 12, Mondays to Fridays, Warren Valentine's Night Talk podcast. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. And on Fridays, Time for an Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. Again, I want to thank our guest that was with us. Go and get her book at the University of Penn Press, and also she said Amazon. I think she does have a website. I don't know whether her book is being sold from the website, but check it out. She did give a code there where you could put in and get the discount, and I moved some papers around. And
PP 20.
Okay. All right. PP 20. Yeah, put it in. I think she said it on the University of Penn site, didn't she?
Right. You get 20% discount.
Good. Yeah, check it out. That was an interesting book, and we're going to have her on to continue the discussion, I guess, in a little while after she kind of gets over to dealing with morning sickness. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school,
have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman.
To save the children.